Chair calls this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 16th?
So moved.
Representative Herr moves the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Minutes are approved. Members, today we have the data practices overview. There are two presentations, and the first from Minnesota Department of Administration iPad. When you hear people talking about iPad, they're not talking about a shiny device. It's the Information Policy and Analysis Division. You guys still call it that, right? Oh, you don't? How long has it not been that?
About a year and a half.
Okay, well, that's reasonable timeline for me not to know then. What's it called now?
Data Practices Office.
Data Practices Office. Well, much easier. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, Data Practices Office, and then you'll hear from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Now, members, this is important because this is the committee to which all data practices provisions will go, and it's since, I think it's 2007, the Minnesota House of Representatives has had Rule 4.16 that has stated that any bill involving Chapter 13 or that practices goes here. And before it was civil law and data practices, now it's going to come here. And the reason why that matters is as technology develops, we're becoming more digital, everything's online, information about you or information for your benefit is subject to those data practices. So it's at its core, it is open government, sunshine, that people should know what their government is doing. And then second, personal privacy. Information that government holds about you should be private and should not be shared with your neighbor or someone having a grudge, you know, or even a law enforcement agency unless they have probable cause or due process to do so. So that's why all of these and how we do that in designating this data is it's default public, or we create a data set, which is a very nerdy term to say who gets to know it and who doesn't. So there are different. So that's what the Data Practices Office will talk about today. And I'd like to welcome the testifiers who've been around longer than I have around here. This is kind of a long time. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Lori Barkopensky. I'm the Director of Community Services for the Department of Administration, and joining me,
I'm Stacey Christensen. I'm the Director of the Data Practices Office. Lori's going to start us off.
And many of you who are new to the Capitol may know of the Department of Administration. We are a very eclectic and diverse agency. We have 24 distinct business units. We take care of your buildings. We help build them for you. We do property leases. We oversee $2.3 billion of purchases of goods and services. But in my community services areas, we are the statewide expert for a variety of things, including the State Demographic Center, the Data Practices Office. We are also the home of the Developmental Disabilities Council and Assistive Technology. So we really have a wide swath. We even include the state archaeologist, and many people don't know we have a state archaeologist. But as the chair mentioned, data practices really touches every Minnesotan and everyone who's here. And as I said, we are the data practices as well as the open meeting law resource for the state. The bulk of what we do is informal advice, calls and emails from members of the public, state and local government, the media, as well as you, the legislature. We assist the commissioner with her duties to issue non-binding advisory opinions, as well as temporary classifications of data. And I'm going to highlight this area. There are currently two temporary classifications that are in place involving bus rideshare data. So once the commissioner has approved them, they then come to you to decide whether or not you think that data should be protected permanently. So you will have until August 1st of 2020 to make that decision about that. We think this is a really fun area. We know that a number of members and the chair think this is a fun area. many people, this is a small part of their job, so we really have a lot of resources, newsletter, Twitter, and our website to really make the most difficult things simple for people who are just trying to do the right thing, they're trying to exercise their rights, or they're in local government and they're trying to make sure they release as much data as they can while also protecting the privacy of our citizens. One thing that most folks don't know we do is we'll help anyone with legislative drafting. Since this is a complex area of state and federal law, we help people, members of the media, as well as legislators, make sure that whatever idea you have for a bill will work with an existing law and that it really does what you want it to do. We also do training across the state, both in person as well as webinars is one area that we're going to move into as well. So we are going to do this kind of as a quiz. So we'll see if you want to, like, show of hands. So this is, so a city has a data request for an official record they could have destroyed 10 years ago, according to their approved retention schedule. Must the city produce the data for the requester? How many people think yes? How many people think? I don't know, and I'm afraid to raise my hand. That's fine, too. Yeah. Okay.
I just gave you the answer. So we won't kind of prolong the misery of trying to answer these questions, but we think that this particular format is a good way to kind of highlight particular questions that we get from folks and then go through the answers. This is also a condensed version of a training that we did for legislative members and staff in December, and I think that folks appreciated it, so we'll kind of do this condensed version for you as well. So this particular slide highlights the relevant laws related to data practices. The most prominent, of course, is Chapter 13, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. This is Minnesota's Freedom of Information Law, as well as Minnesota's privacy law. So in Minnesota, the legislature made a decision to combine both of those laws into one, which puts Minnesota in a unique position among the other states and the federal government. Most have two separate openness, public records laws, and privacy laws. So to further the complexity, we're dealing with kind of both issues in one law. So as Chair Lesh mentioned, the presumption in Minnesota is that all government data is public unless there's a specific classification for the data. And you as the legislature get to decide what those classifications are. So if you deem something that is presumptively public to need protection, you make those decisions. Federal law can also classify data. So agencies that are working with kind of federal agencies or those types of resources may have some federal classifications for their data.
And
in addition,
can I stop you for a second?
Yes.
There? Members, especially for those of you who are new to this committee, I don't think it can be stressed too much how significant this distinction is, okay? So for those of you all who are wondering why Fox, Mulder, and Dana Scully can't get information about why the aliens are coming, okay, on the X-Files, FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, is a federal law, okay? And it is eaten up by its exceptions and its loopholes to its general requirement that government disclose data. As we all know, you can't get squat from the federal government unless they find some way to decide they're going to disclose it. That's for various reasons, including national defense issues, diplomatic reasons, trade reasons, and everything. But in Minnesota, if the government collects data, it is by default public, available to you, unless this committee has created a data set to say why it shouldn't be. So I wanted to stress that to you. It's a pretty significant source of our sunshine laws, open government, open information. Anyway, thanks for that sidebar, Ms. Christensen.
I appreciate that, too. It is very different kind of operating under the federal exemption standard than we have in Minnesota, so that's a great point. It also, because it's a privacy law, provides privacy rights for individuals when we have private data about them. Individuals get to make sure that government is accurately protecting their data, that the data are correct, current, and individuals can challenge that with government entities if they think that there is some issue with their data. So it gives individuals those rights. It also includes a very kind of basic high-level security requirement that data have to be kept secure and protected when they are classified as not public. In addition, the other related laws, well, first we have administrative rules. So if the Data Practices Act wasn't complex and long enough for you, you can also cure insomnia by reading the administrative rules in Chapter 1205. They do provide really good guidance, though, for data and individuals. Sometimes when government has questions about the responsible authorities, obligations, or copy costs, for example, there's good guidance there. The other two related laws are the Official Records Act and Records Management Statute. So those laws are basically saying government has to maintain official records so the public knows what government is doing and why they're doing, and also so folks that kind of come after different government officials know what was done and why it was done. The Records Management Statute says you have to have a specific retention period for your official records. So entities determine what records are their official records, place them on a retention schedule, and decide, is something permanent? Should something be kept for 1 year? Should something be kept for 7 years? All of those decisions have to go through what's called a records disposition panel to approve those records retention schedules at government entities. Related to kind of this overall idea of the Data Practices Act, I have two slides that talk about kind of when entities get, government entities get data requests, how they respond to them, and what they can charge for them. So in terms of response time, it makes a difference who's asking for the data. If a member of the public asks for public data, the entity has to respond within a reasonable amount of time that's appropriate in the circumstances. So there's not a 30-day requirement or a 60-day requirement. It has to be reasonable based on the circumstances. For a data subject, however, and a data subject is that individual that the government maintains data about. So they've collected private or public data about them, and they're maintaining those data. Those requests have to be complied with immediately, or if possible, or within 10 business days. So government is always putting those data subject requests on the top of their list because they do have that really specific time to respond. In terms of charging, it's important to point out that one of the, you know, real fundamental pieces of the Data Practices Act is that inspection of government data is always free. So government can never charge if someone wants to come in and look at the files that they're maintaining on a particular topic. However, if someone wants copies, government can charge. It's a complicated area now that we're dealing more with electronic records because the guidance for electronic data is actual cost. So that's going to vary from data request to data request. There's not kind of a set fee. Paper copies is really easy. It's 25 cents a page. However, most folks aren't looking for paper copies. So government has to do that kind of determination of actual cost, which includes the time it takes for employees to search for and retrieve government data. However, government still can't charge for redacting or kind of pulling out the not public data from the public data. So that's something that government can't pass on to the requester. For data subjects, it's really kind of a minimal charge when they're requesting their data.
And this is the area where the office gets some of the most questions. We get questions about law enforcement data, employee data, and copy costs. Those are the big three, and they've remained the big three probably for the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. The next question is, the written notes taken during a school board meeting, are they government data?
So this is our common answer. It depends. Probably. Probably in this situation, but I probably use the phrase, it depends, if not daily, certainly weekly. You know, there are shades of gray in this law. So, and that's why we're there. That's why we're there to help, and we're there to help troubleshoot. But this is to highlight.
Before you stop taking notes here, note that the legislature is not subject to the Data Practices Act, so your notes and doodles won't be disclosed here.
Share less, you stole my thunder.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know too much. We'll get to that. So this slide is to highlight the definition of government data. And government data is everything that a government entity maintains in some sort of recorded form. So as you can see on this slide, it really does cover everything. There is not an exception for working papers in our law, which again is different than probably the federal government and some other states. There has to be a specific classification for the data that the legislature decides. And we always say even post-it notes can be government data. The only thing that is not government data are our mental impressions as government employees, and that was actually litigated, believe it or not. So it really does cover everything except an employee's thoughts.
So thoughts written down?
Thoughts written down are government data once they're written down. Yes.
And so this is where we get to the distinction. So an email that from your legislative email address to your mom about her birthday is the government data, but we all know the answer already. And the second is when one of you, state agency employee, I use my personal email address to respond to one of your legislative questions. Is that government data?
All right, so this is to highlight. In that first question, no. So the legislature and the courts are not subject to the Data Practices Act in the same way that state agencies, local governments, school districts are subject to the Data Practices Act. So your email correspondence is treated differently than what would a government entity's employee email be treated. However, kind of highlighting this distinction of personal email accounts and government email accounts, this is certainly something that's been in the news and gotten a lot of attention in recent years in all levels of government, that a work-related email from a personal account is still government data. Now, it's important to point out that doesn't open up the entire personal account to being government data. It's really just that one particular email or two emails that are sent. But just because someone uses a personal account doesn't mean they can kind of remove themselves from the requirements of the Data Practices Act. This is just to highlight the approach that the legislature took to how data are classified. And I'm not going to get into the details about this. You can look at this in your leisure time to kind of draw those distinctions. But just as a high-level overview, there are three types of data. Public data, which we know are available to anyone for any reason. Private data, also known as non-public data, when they are not on individuals, that has a limited, the public basically does not have access to that, and only employees within an entity with a work assignment have access. And then the highest level of classification is confidential or protected non-public, and that means that the data subject does not even have access to those data. And the real big example of that is investigative data, both civil investigative data and criminal investigative data, where it would jeopardize the investigation should the data subject have access while an investigation is ongoing. And we'll talk a little bit about how that classification changes when it becomes inactive.
And also, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt us at any point. So this is to highlight another important area. A state agency is in the process of investigating a complaint against one of its employees, and they get a data request about that complaint. What can the government release?
So as Lori mentioned, personnel data is one of those top three areas that we get questions about. We have a full-day workshop training that we do just on personnel data. So this is a complicated area that, again, we could talk about all day. But this one particular question highlights kind of a big area that we hear about in the media a lot. You know, when a school district has some sort of issue with an employee and, you know, the public wants to know what's going on. While a complaint or charge about an employee is pending, only the existence and status of that complaint is public. That's it. So that could potentially change once an investigation is finished. If there's discipline and there's a what's called a final disposition of discipline. More data could become public. But at that very initial stage, when you hear government entities say, you know, we can't say anything more than a complaint exists, that's accurate. They're actually prohibited by the Data Practices Act from saying anything more. So it really depends on where the entity is in their investigation.
I wanted to highlight for members that when you see this, you'll start noticing it more in the media. So a few months ago, you saw a kind of a high-profile backpedal from Mayor Jacob Frey in announcing discipline for a particular police officer. That was because of this law. Mayors and officials who want to come out against what is perceived as bad behavior or bad conduct want to do it immediately because the public demands it. They can't legally do it because of this law. They have to wait till final disposition. Years before that, my own city, Mayor Coleman, was not allowed to say anything about discipline about a particular police officer who subsequently resigned because of this law. But there was a huge hue and cry from his constituents and your constituents because of that. So just be aware of that, that their hands are tied to a certain extent, and you will see bills coming before this committee repeatedly because of that provision. So I just want to point that out. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and members, too, one of the things to know in those situations, too, that the data subject, so the employee who, the alleged bad actor employee, can say anything they want, and that doesn't give government permission to be able to respond, even if what the employee is saying is not true. So just remember that the government is really going to be limited in what they can say. The next one is you have an individual who is shot at a private home. 911 calls, gets the police to the house, and a suspect is arrested. There's an active criminal investigation going on in the incident, and of course the local media has requested information. They want the names of witnesses, they want the name and date of birth and the city of the residence of the alleged shooter, and they also want the address of where the shooting took place. Can the media have access?
All right, and this is to highlight our last kind of top three topic of law enforcement data. And the law enforcement data is an area that we get lots of questions, again, have a full day workshop on. We can talk all day about it. But this is to highlight that even during kind of an active investigation, there are certain data elements that are always public, that the public gets to know. So names of witnesses. Those are public unless the data identifies individuals that qualify for protection. So there are certain provisions in the law enforcement data section that allow a law enforcement agency to make determinations on a case-by-case basis to protect certain witnesses. But generally, the names of witnesses are public. The name, date of birth, and residence of the shooter, again, is public as arrest data. Arrest data is one of those categories that is always public, even in an active investigation. In addition, response or incident data and request for service data. Those particular data elements are always public. Law enforcement does have the option to temporarily withhold active investigative data. But as soon as someone is detained, arrested, or otherwise deprived of their liberty, that data is public as arrest data. The address where the shooting took place, again, is public as response or incident data. It's the place of action. So that's what data that are always public.
Representative
Levin,
do you have a question?
No,
I did.
Oh.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, Chair Lesh. Just asking about in cases of juveniles, what information can be public if they're juvenile?
Ms. Christensen.
Great question. So juveniles are treated differently. Juvenile bad actors. So there's a distinction between a juvenile witness that may just have been there, is not a bad actor, and a juvenile that may have, you know, some involvement in the criminal activity. There's a whole other section outside of the Data Practices Act in Section 260B or Chapter 260B that protects juvenile data on delinquent or maybe delinquent juveniles. So, yes, that's a great question, a great clarification. We're talking about adults here.
Thank you.
So the next one, and I think this highlights that technology has really required the Data Practices Act to evolve and change. And so we have a situation where officers are responding to a domestic disturbance. They've activated their body cams. The officers enter the home, and they observe a man hitting a woman, a child, as well as another adult woman are in the same room. The officers arrest the man for assault. The officers then interview each of the adults before leaving the scene. The case is still active. And the next day, the neighbor asks for a copy of the body cam video. What should you release to the neighbor?
All right. This is to highlight, I think, one of those areas that the legislature spent a lot of time and did an excellent job in kind of weighing those transparency versus privacy rights and coming up with a scheme of classification related to body camera data. It certainly was a painstaking process to get to the point of how these particular data are classified, but it is, in my opinion, was a really good example of how those discussions took place and how that balancing happens at the legislature. So with body camera data, while an investigation is active, all of the data in the video are confidential, so the same as any other kind of law enforcement data. So the neighbor would have no access to the data. So remember, confidential means that no one outside of the entity has access. When the investigation becomes inactive, body camera data in this circumstance are private. There are specifically defined situations where body camera data could become public after an investigation is done, but in this situation, the data remain private. So that means the neighbor has no access to the video. Those individuals within the video could have access to the video in certain situations. However, I do want to point out...
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to point out that the neighbor would have access to any data in the public incident report. So the data classification for body camera data is just that medium. Any other data related to that incident in a written form potentially are public and available to the neighbor.
Rips of her.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Quick question, though. So what happens if the incident happens in a public place, though? Does that, because when I was on the police civilian review board, certain videos they said could be made public as long as they blurred out the public's faces and just left the people involved in the incident. So I'm just curious, does it matter if an incident happens in a public space or in a private space?
That's a great question. And what the legislature decided is there was not a distinction there. So even if it happened in a home or it happened in a public space, the classification is going to be the same. The subject of the video does have the ability to release those, the video, if all of the other kind of subjects give consent or their identities are blurred out. So good question.
Now, Representative Herr, something that we have been dealing with is if the only relevant copy that remains is one that's contained in a personnel data file, then it follows the personnel data rules, even if it occurred in a public space or what have you. I'm sure that issue will come back again this year, but there are a lot of demarcations raised by your question. Oh, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I note that the scenarios of the domestic disturbance, are there distinctions when it involves a police officer shooting? And can you tell us what that might be?
Ms. Christensen.
Yes, so that those are the distinctions that I kind of mentioned, that if there is a shooting with substantial bodily harm, that's when some of those videos are going to become public after the investigation is complete.
Okay. Chair Mariani.
And Mr. Chair, it seems to me that, or not seems to me, it's my understanding that that there's some element of local authority discretion that's involved with that. We know that recently we've had mayors that have made available video footage. And my understanding is that there's room in law and in practice for local authorities to be able to have a level of discretion on that, regardless of whatever, well, maybe not regardless, consistent with our data privacy laws.
Ms. Christensen.
I think you raise an excellent point. A couple of points that I'll kind of get to. So in terms of local discretion, the body camera section does require entities that have body cameras to have policies and procedures around those. So the law doesn't cover, you know, when cameras have to be turned on or off, if officers can review the cameras. That was something that was left to local control. In terms of the release, there's a provision in the law enforcement section that allows, it's called public benefit data, so it allows law enforcement to release what would otherwise be confidential data, basically to get the public's help in kind of, you know, trying to find someone or trying to, you know, get the public's assistance in a particular matter. So there is that discretion there for law enforcement data in particular. Yep.
Sure. Any other questions? I did. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sitting here trying to remember what we decided about retention for body camera. Where did we land on how long it has to be retained, or did we answer that question? I'm looking at former Chair Scott, because he probably knows off the top of
my head. Chair Scott, you remember?
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I'll let them take that on, but I thought it was, is it 90 days or 6 months? Is it a year?
Oh, 60 days, I think.
No, I think it's a year.
See, I was
60 days for license plate readers. In a year for body cam. It wasn't the same, so we'll let the professional.
You guys get paid to know the top of your head, right?
So my answer is it depends.
I was going to say
no wonder we couldn't nail it down. I know. Never go wrong with that answer. I appreciate this question because the license plate readers and the body cameras are the first time that we've seen specific retention periods put into statute. And so I'm not going to talk about the license plate readers in particular, but with body cameras, it depends on, you know, if someone has asked law enforcement to keep their video longer for exculpatory evidence or otherwise. But generally speaking, it's going to depend on the law enforcement agency's retention schedule that they've set for those body cameras.
And I wanted to highlight this for members of the committee. I do retain some discretion as chair to do that, and I'm going to do that right now because I think it will highlight some of the issues that are going to be coming down the pike. In my opinion, for the first time, this collection of data that we've had places into law express permission for law enforcement to collect information on innocent individuals and hold that information on innocent individuals, because you are innocent until you're proven guilty, with no probable cause to do so for those individuals, on the chance that maybe that they could break the law later and we could go back and look and see if they were breaking the law. That bothers me greatly, some other folks it doesn't bother because they weigh the balance test. Well, that's fine. If we catch a few people, it's okay for us to be monitoring and evaluating everyone else. That'll be a discussion that we have at some point, but it's a discussion that was brought on mostly by the advent of this new technology, like the cell phone exploitation devices, the license plate readers, and the body cams. Now, with body cams, it's a little bit different because you've got three and even four-dimensional aspects to that data. But that is something that we'll probably be bringing up, and I'm sure we'll have a vigorous discussion on it, and there are differences of opinion on both sides of the aisle on that. My question, though, related to the practice that people have heard of as called swatting, where you're angry at someone or you're going to bait someone, and so you call in a 911 call to your ex-girlfriend's address saying that there's someone there with a gun, and then they go in and the SWAT team goes in and pins everyone down, yada, yada, yada. And then there has been occasions where folks have tried to get a hold of that body cam data, not in Minnesota, but in other locations in order to embarrass the individuals that they were angry at. What you're saying is our law provides specific protections against that kind of thing happening in Minnesota. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I also wanted to mention, too, when we think about the records retention statute, it sets minimums for how long government needs to keep official records. It doesn't prevent them from keeping it much longer than the retention schedule. Of course, we train people, you should be following your retention schedule and keeping your, you know, keeping the records you need and getting rid of the ones you don't. But I think that the policy decisions around license plate reader and body cam have really highlighted wanting to make sure that certain data isn't maintained longer than it's needed, and you got you all having a say in how that happens. So the next question is, can I ask for an advisory opinion?
So it depends. So the Commissioner of Administration has authority to issue non-binding advisory opinions on both data.
One moment, Ms. Christensen. Chair Scott.
Yeah, I don't know, thank you, Mr. Chair, if this goes back to Representative Mariani's issue or not, but there are some classifications, there are some times that if data is, what is it called? It has to do with common sensibilities, or if it's really offensive, then they won't release the data either. So there are exclusions along the way in our current law, as you're learning, but that is also one of them. But they won't release it if it's offensive to you know, common sensibilities and that sort of thing.
Thank you for that clarification, Chair Scott. Ms. Christensen.
So the commissioner has authority to issue non-binding advisory opinions on both data practices and open meeting law issues, but it depends on who's asking for the advisory opinion. So both government entities and the public can ask for these opinions. Government entities have the ability to ask for opinions about their own data, basically data classification, that type of thing. For members of the public, there has to be some sort of dispute. With the government entity, they've made a data request and they're not getting the data, or they think that government has improperly released their data. Legislative members and staff are treated as members of the public because you're not subject to the Data Practices Act in the same way as a government entity would be in that situation.
And this question highlights, are there penalties for violating the Data Practices Act?
And the answer to this is yes. So it's not, and it depends. There absolutely are. There are civil remedies that are available through the court process. There are criminal penalties for intentional willful violations of the law. There's also an administrative remedy. So individuals can go to the Office of Administrative Hearings and file an action to compel compliance and get an administrative order. And then advisory opinions, as I mentioned.
Ms. Christensen, or Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, do you have information on how much the state and local governments have paid out in recent years on violations of the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Chair and members, we hear about some of those things anecdotally, but we don't have a total number or track that.
Okay. If there would be a way to find that out, that would be helpful. Members, this is really important because sometimes we tend to, with a wink and a nod, say, well, we don't care if that data gets out because it serves our purposes or whatever. But we do pay for that. When we create data sets and don't adequately monitor them or enforce how that data gets out or leaks, there is a cost to us to do that. So keep that in mind. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Just a quick question. This might be in the weeds, and you can tell me if maybe I could just reach out to you offline. But I'm just curious. So when I worked at the school district, everything, you know, was public unless it was student data. I noticed, though, that when charter schools are considered public schools, but it seems much harder to get data from charter schools. Are they subject to the same data practices concerning their classification as public schools and having a board that oversees them as well?
Yes, charter schools are treated in the same way as public school districts. I know we do get a lot of questions related to charter schools, and I think that some of it may be because of they don't have the kind of bigger school district that is guiding them through some of these, you know, obligations that they have. So they maybe just don't know that they're subject. But we certainly have worked with, you know, MDE in the past and trying to make sure that they're well aware of their obligations. But, yes, they're.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Herr, we also see whenever you have government entities that are very tiny, say a watershed district or a very small city that might have a half-time city clerk, it complying with this law seems to be more of a challenge. And I think also we have generational shifting of how do you keep everyone trained and really well-informed about their obligations. So where do you go for help? You all know this now.
Us. So we did used to be known as iPad. That was our name. People still do call us iPad. We will answer to any name you call us. But we are the Data Practices Office. We have a website with lots of information. We have short videos. We have PowerPoints. We have information pages. And really, truly, when we say call us or email us when you have a question, do, because that is why we exist. We are there to help and answer your questions. So, if you don't have any other questions, we really thank you for your time, and feel free to reach out.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Christensen and Ms. Beyer-Kopinski. They have been excellent resources for us in this committee for a long time, so we will definitely be inviting you back, and you will be back, I'm sure, to testify on other bills, too. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I'm just wondering if you're going to do the homework assignment for this weekend for the freshmen to read Chapter 13?
Oh. Yes. Thank you, Representative Johnson. That is an assignment, and there will be a quiz. Ironically, though, it won't be just the freshmen who fail that quiz. It'll find everybody. But thank you for pointing that out. And I would, to that point, members, I would encourage you to read Chapter 13. Yes, at the front end of reading it, and most of it's going to look like Greek, but it will help you to clarify when we're talking about these important provisions. It'll ring a bell that was right there in the data practice of that. That's what we defer to. So thank you. Thanks again for being here. Members, the next testifiers that will be coming up will be from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Now, as they're taking the stage, I guess as he's taking the stage, I would point out that it's always a good idea, especially for the freshmen here, to do a little check on the billables quotient of who's approaching the testifiers table. And a lot of people get paid to sit here and testify. They represent clients, and there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. All you big spenders out there, we love you, okay? And it's very important you're here, okay? They're also representing clients, and everyone who comes up here has an agenda, the purity of which falls on a scale. At the top of that purity level, I think I can safely say, are testifiers like the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. They don't get paid to be here. They're here because they care about the privacy of your information, as well as accountability of government to you to make sure that we are transparent in how we operate. And they're kind of nerds, frankly, on that point. They get down into the weeds on this stuff that you don't notice the consequences of it until 5 years later when all this other stuff is coming online. So I feel really grateful that they're here. They're well studied in this information. With that, Mr. Ehling, please introduce yourself and take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Ehling. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. As the chair mentioned, we are an all-volunteer, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. Our membership is comprised of librarians, folks that work in the media like myself, attorneys, IT professionals, people who deal with government data issues. Mr. Hal Davis, formerly the Pioneer Press, from our board is here. So we track these issues as they come before the legislature. We're focused on open and transparent government, and we'd like to hold ourselves out as a resource to all of you to discuss these issues at any time. The reason why this is important an important policy area is that really open government in concert with our constitutionally guaranteed rights such as freedom of speech, freedom to petition the government for redress or grievances, really is the underpinning of public policy. It's what makes public policy happen. And without knowledge about what their government is up to, citizens really have no basis to understand the actions that are being undertaken in their name, and thus no ability to engage in debates over the policies that affect them. So that's why we feel this is so important. Now, as a state, as Minnesotans, we really are the inheritors of a pretty robust government transparency legacy. The generation that passed these laws initially, many of them were grandparents to us. They came from a time where there was not easy access to government information. John Finnegan, the late editor of the Pioneer Press, spent many, many, many months and years at knocking at the door of government offices, at city halls and other government offices, trying to get government records without success. This was in the 1950s and 60s. By the 1970s, Watergate had happened. The political environment was ripe for a change, and Mr. Finnegan and others petitioned the legislature to put in place a framework for accessing government information that became the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And that put in place the presumption that all government data is public unless otherwise classified, as you've heard talked about this morning. Since this committee is charged with overseeing important functions of this transparency legacy, I want to highlight some of those important statutes that you'll be dealing with. One of them you won't necessarily be dealing with in this committee, but those all of you will be touching aspects of another one of these things in your role as legislators. So if you look on the back side of our sheet, you'll see four different statutes, starting with the Minnesota Open Meeting Law. And again, this is the open meeting law issues will not come to this committee, but you will be hearing about them. There's an open meeting law issue we would like to have the legislature address this year that I can speak to if folks have questions about it. But if you look at the open meeting law, this goes back to the 1950s when it was put on the books. And it basically says that there's a requirement for many government entities in the state to have open and transparent meetings where the public can physically come in and watch the proceedings. You know, back before the advent of electronic communications, this was really the coin of the realm for access to governmental process for citizens. And it's still important today, having that personal connection to watch government proceedings. As I said, there is an issue that's arisen because of a Supreme Court case that was decided recently, and that impacts how penalties can be assessed for violations of the open meeting law. So that's what we'd like to see the legislature address this year, and I can speak to that if there's questions. If you look down the list, you'll see some of the records retention statutes that were previously mentioned, including the the Official Records Act and the Records Management Statute. Again, the Official Records Act was put on the books in the 1940s. This really shows that the state has, for a very long time, put a premium on government transparency. And both that and the Records Management Statute deal with this question of how long does government need to retain pieces of information. And this is an issue that we have taken up as a policy issue in the past because of things like government agencies getting rid of their emails in an untimely fashion. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, for instance, switched to a 90-day destruction period for emails. We fear that the public is losing important pieces of information they should have access to. So those questions about how long should certain pieces of government information be maintained for are sort of evergreen issues that we focus on. Finally, at the bottom, you'll see the Data Practices Act, the statute that was talked about at some length this morning already. Again, this was put in place by John Finnegan, a journalist, and other people who were journalism practitioners, and also people who were data policy and IT practitioners in the early days of the IT business. And that's reflected really in the title of the statute. This is not an open record statute. This is a government data statute. And that was very intentionally done by the framers of the Act, including Don Gemberling, who was on our board, who had a very extensive role in writing this law over time. And the idea was to define government data in such a broad way that you could not have the government play games by saying, well, this piece of data is not government data, so you can't have access to it. So that was the intention, and the intention was also to look over the horizon to new and emerging issues. It was written during the 1970s. When paper was really the transaction medium for a lot of government work, but it saw the advent of electronic records coming, and it was written with that in mind. As I've mentioned, with its roots in the journalism trade, the Data Practices Act has certainly enabled a vibrant press. It was meant to do that, and we've seen that down to the present day. If you look in the media, many of the stories that you see on the front pages of the Star Tribune, the Pioneer Press, those are coming from data practices requests. A couple of prominent examples in recent years would be the Star Tribune series on sex assault investigations, the Star Tribune series on elder abuse, both of which have caused policy change within the state and policy discussions. But beyond its role for use by the press, John Finnegan wanted to craft a law for the people. He wanted to make sure that any individual citizen could also use this law outside of just somebody who's a professional journalist. And you see to this day that the vast majority of the calls that we get as an organization come from individual citizens, people who are looking to get access to information about governmental process. And we've talked to all manner of folks. I've talked to people just within this last year trying to get closed police investigative files for historical research purposes, pet owners looking for licensing information, people who have a question about how a city has made a determination about their property, and one person who sought information about a state-licensed nursing home where a loved one had unfortunately passed away. And so these folks are calling us trying to find out how they can get access to information. Sometimes we can steer them through questions that they have to get to a resolution, but sometimes their only resolution is through the legislative process because there's been a determination that certain pieces of information are not public. And so that's where we get involved, is that if we encounter situations where there is information that should be public, we will advocate for it to be public. When we see bills that are coming that would try to change already public information into not public information, and we're concerned that there's not a good policy reason for that, that's when we raise questions. Sometimes there are legitimate policy issues that are raised, but a bill is brought forward that's too broad in scope, and so we will try to help legislators narrow it so it really achieves the targeted purpose that would address the policy issue. And as has also been talked about, a major reason that this committee is going to be dealing with data practices issues is technology. These issues are not going away. They're only going to proliferate over time. A good example was the license plate reader technology that folks had mentioned this morning. This was a very, very complicated issue because it involved questions of what should the public know about how the government is using this controversial technology. It involves questions of the government collecting information about individuals and holding on to it, and questions about how long should that information be maintained, as well as who can have information like that shared with them. So those are some of the thorny issues that arise from these technological questions. Right now, yes?
I'm going to bring up one point about this, members. Mr. Ayling highlighted some of the newspaper headlines that have been the subject of, have been, I guess, the product of Data Practices Act. One of them that, I guess, put a lot of work before this committee was a 2012 article in the Star Tribune that tracked the location of Mayor Ryback and his daily routine, Mayor of Minneapolis, as he went around the city from day to day. And that was due to the fact that automated license plate readers were online for the Minneapolis Police Department that snapped shots randomly of his car passing police cars without the officer even knowing it. And then later the metadata from all of those was cobbled together to form a daily routine of the mayor of Minneapolis without anyone knowing, because this committee had not yet created the data set to make that data anything other than public, and it was default public. And so it probably wasn't the most, noble use of the Data Practices Act by the media on that occasion, but it did reveal a loophole that we ended up having to deal with, and we will continue to have to deal with some of those loopholes as time goes on and technology develops, whether it be facial recognition technology or what have you. Representative Johnson, did you have a question?
Just a comment on what you were saying. And that's one of the issues that we deal with in this committee, keeping the information that should be public and trying to prevent the private data of the citizens from coming public.
And you reminded me, too, I think there was another instance of a repo man getting a hold of the location of a car that he needed a repo, passing a certain location every day, and he just laid an ambush, waited until the guy parked, and then towed it away, which is kind of funny. But certainly, I don't think government is in the business of enabling that kind of thing. You want to repo a car, do the work on your own. But I'm sorry for the interruption, Mr. Ealing. Go ahead.
No problem at all. To Representative Johnson's point, I think that's an interesting point. One of the reasons for the complexity of the statute is not only the open government issues that come up, but from the beginning, the Data Practices Act also incorporated privacy protections. It's sort of baked into the way the law is structured. So it's different from a lot of other open record laws that you see around in other states around the country. Those are mostly modeled on the Federal Freedom of Information Act, which is explicitly an open record statute. This contains both open records provisions and privacy protection provisions, so it makes for a much more expansive and complicated statute sometimes. Finally, in closing, and there's a couple.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, so you talked about the license plate reader. And think about it, if it was a woman that was experiencing domestic violence or had been raped and the person that assaulted her was trying to find her, and it would be just as easy for him to find her in that way, too. So we have the Safe at Home through the Secretary of State's office, and it would be just egregious to have that data now public because the whole point of it was to keep her protected. So that would be another instance. And then you talked about the Star Tribune articles and what happens after rape, and the answer is literally almost nothing. So, you know, after 8 articles. But it's important to point out that that was metadata, and they didn't release any private data for the individual victims unless they wanted to tell their story. So some victims came forward and told their story, but that didn't come from police records. It was something that they had relationships with people. But I think it's important for us to understand, too, that this can be life and death if we don't properly take care of the data, that a woman could be killed or raped or worse, you know, somewhere in between. Or a child or, you know, another person. But it's really important to keep the data private, especially in those violent situations. But I'm really thankful for the Star Tribune. I just want to get that on the record, too, that they did this incredible, you know, 7, 8, 9-part series. I can't remember how many articles about what happens after rape, and we'll be dealing with that in this committee and a couple other ones, too. So I look forward to working with that across the aisle and get that some of those loopholes kind of tied up.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Representative. Mr. Ealing.
In closing out the discussion of some of the technical aspects or technological aspects that drive these debates, I would note that there are very, very complex issues that are going to be coming at the legislature in coming years. One issue that we are looking at as a board is how do you address the utilization that is coming of artificial intelligence platforms by government entities, whereby proprietary software will be used to make certain determinations, and the public will not be able to access the data because it's proprietary trade secret data in many cases, and they will not be able to understand the mechanisms by which those determinations are being made. How do you address that from a transparency standpoint? This will be a major, major issue across the country, and we hope to get our arms around it here in the state of Minnesota. Finally, in closing, I would note that an important part of the history of transparency in the state, if you look back over the decades in which these laws have been passed, is that this has been a bipartisan enterprise. And we're very fortunate in this state to have, in every decade, champions from both parties arise and work together on these issues because they are so critically important. We feel this really sort of highlights the best calling of people in the political process and the public process, since their work on these issues protects the ability of citizens, no matter what their issue, no matter what their perspective, to be able to fully understand the workings of their government and participate in the political process. So we would like to highlight that. I will close with just an observation, two questions raised by Representative Furr and Mariani in regard to the body camera issue. This was another very complex issue that we were deeply involved in tracking. One of the quirks of the way it turned out that we would like to see, you know, readdressed or remedied in some point in the future is that prior to the enactment of the body camera law, video captured by a law enforcement agency was pretty much categorized and dealt with the same way. So there are exceptions where you can withhold or retain information that identifies certain people, as Ms. Christensen talked about. Video prior to that had been treated under those kind of standards. So squad car video, for instance, is for the most part presumed public even today. But if it identifies, say, an undercover officer or a protected victim, for instance, that can be redacted. Those portions of the video can be redacted. And body camera was treated under the same kind of standards until the body camera law was passed. When the bill on the House side came out, the bill initially said all body camera video will be not public, categorically, which we had large concerns with. And so we worked to try to pull out relevant portions of that video that impact governmental process and that people should know about. But at the end of the day, there is now a discrepancy between how body camera video is treated and how squad car or surveillance camera or other video held by a law enforcement agency is treated. So,
and members, as Mr. Ealing closes, I would point out the really difficult balance of unintended consequences we encounter on some of these decisions. For example, on the squad dash cam videos, I seem to recall a former member of this body who was stopped for a DWI, I don't know, probably 5 years ago. They made him do the stupid human tricks, you know, on the side of the road there for a DWI test and put a jug of vodka on the squad hood right in front of the camera. And that video was made public within, I think, 12 hours of the stop, which, you know, I thought was a little bit exploitative and unnecessary. Irritated me a bit, but it's one of the downstream spillover effects of how we decide how we're going to disclose information in this body. Also, to your point about the artificial intelligence platforms, members, as we increasingly outsource government functions to private entities, we lose control of how that is used. It, regardless, you know, whether you're talking about healthcare, those of you who are healthcare people, we can't seem to get data on how the government spends $9 billion of our dollars per year and whether their appropriate costs are being paid for an arthroscopic knee surgery or what have you, because the outsourced entity, the HMOs, hold that data. Similarly, with the Timberjay bill from 2000, I don't know what it was, 13 or something, The Ely Unified School District was building a school, a couple of schools, and Ely Timberjay, Marshall Helmberger, the editor, publisher, asked the costs associated with those schools that were being built. Well, the Ely Unified School District outsourced that to Johnson Controls. Johnson Controls further subbed the contract out to various people, Johnson Controls says, go ask the subs. And the sub says, we're not subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. So there was an entire Supreme Court case that said, yes, they're not subject to it. They don't have to tell you how much they're spending on a gym floor or a bathroom stall divider or a chalkboard. I guess they don't buy chalkboards anymore, right? But whatever. smart boards, which is, I think, offensive to the common sensibilities of a legislative body that we are entitled to know how much is being spent on. That was the result of the entire Packard Commission in 1986, when the Pentagon was found to have spent $400 on a hammer and $650 on a toilet seat. It's offensive to the public. We are entitled to know what our tax dollars are being used for. And that is, at its core, government data practices. You're all entitled to know that. It's something that brings Democrats and Republicans together, absolutely, and we need to pay attention to it. So I want to point that out to you. Those kinds of things will continue to bubble up, and they will at their core be subject matter and fodder for this committee. The last thing that I would want to say is relating to the Minnesota Data Practices Commission. We created that commission, and it was driven by a former representative here that wanted to make sure that folks were trained in on how we handle data practices and that we train people in on how to use them. And I don't know if any – I forgot to ask the speaker, Chair Scott, if any changes have been made on that as a result of the new majority, or if the statutory language even calls for any changes. Go ahead, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our caucus just received the handout where you could sign up to be on different commissions and different task forces, and that was one of them. So there will that will be turning over. The membership of that will be turning over now, basically. But I believe the gavel goes back over to the Senate. I think it alternates.
Okay.
Is it every year or every biennium? I don't remember. But,
well,
but we do have to refund that as well.
We have to what? Refund?
I believe that, Mr. Chair, we have to refund the Data Practices Commission.
Okay. Okay.
Not refund as in right. Refund.
Right. Okay.
Refund.
Well, members, some of the ideas that come before this committee will be the direct result of the work done on that commission, which is both House and Senate. And it is kind of nuanced in the issues that it deals with. But they, as you've heard by the real-world impacts of what we talk about in this committee, they're still very important. So any other questions for Mr. Ealing while we have him here? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have more of a comment. It's not necessarily to Mr. Ealing, but just a comments to the committee in general that we have a culture here in Minnesota of protecting people's privacy. And I had the opportunity over the interim to meet with a group of delegates, if you will, from South Africa, the country of South Africa, and they were interested in the Data Practices Act and how we handle things. And one of the things that astonished me was that every single one of their citizens is fingerprinted, and the government holds their fingerprints. And I said, I asked clarifying questions. Is this true that, you know, you have fingerprints on every single citizen? And they said, oh, well, yeah, that helps us fight crime. So my point there is one of the things that we struggle with in this committee is the ends justifying the means, and where is that balancing point or the breaking point? But I want to stress again that we have this culture of protecting people's privacy. So whether that's our health records, whether that's our location, where we're going about the city on our own, our private lives, that we want to maintain that culture of personal privacy in our state.
Thank you. Thank you for that comment, Chair Scott. Representative Leedley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has been very interesting, and look forward to continuing to be part of these discussions. Since we have a moment, and you kind of brought up the Timberjay issue and the issue about the health care, I wanted to just maybe explore that a bit, because it has been on my mind to sort of understand where we are with that, because I recall there was an effort by the health plans. We're talking about, you know, this was some years ago, after that Timberjay, there was an effort for them to, I think the Timberjay decision, this is where I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, and maybe staff can help us here, or maybe Mr. Ealing knows the answer, but that the Timberjay decision basically said if the private entity is doing something in the shoes of government, taking over from government to do it, that the privacy of the data issue is the same, so that they in fact have to reveal the data if government would have had to reveal it. But at the time, there was a lot of consternation about the health plans, to whom we pay billions of dollars to run our public health programs. And there was some kind of a short-term amendment to protect that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was, which passed, and it was like a year or two of protection for their data. And then that expired. There was a lot of consternation, but then that expired. And since then, my understanding is that that data, in fact, is not protected, that it is public, but I haven't seen anybody go and try to get it. Is that your understanding, or is that staff's understanding of where we are with that issue?
Well, Chair Liebling, I think this is a perfect moment for an awkward silence. Yes, that is my recollection. And members, this is a big deal, okay? I would point out, you know, $9 billion a year, that's a huge chunk of the state budget that we don't know how it's spent or why it's spent. Yes, that amendment to suspend the application of this law or clarification of the law for 1 year was offered by the health plans, and when that expired, nothing happened. My understanding was that their objection to disclosing this government data at that point then became trade secret or some other kind of objection, okay? But it has not been litigated in terms of the groups that I've talked to about that. Litigating something like that against the HMOs is daunting, to say the least, and that's going to be the prerogative of your committee. But I can tell you that I think my biggest issue, Chair Liebling, is that no real adequate justification has been brought to me. They have a huge trade secret reason to hold back on it. That's they can say that, but they can say it to me, or they can say it to this committee, or they can explain it there. It hasn't been explained to me. Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you and I think, are pretty much on the same page on this, but I just want to say a couple of things about that. One is that I even though there is a great deal of difficulty in getting a lot of the data that they have, and we're not talking about patients, individual patient data. That would be one thing, but the kind of data I think many people are interested in is, you know, what are they really paying a provider of health care? We as legislators don't know that. But I do want to just push back a little bit on your characterization that I just think is a bit of an overstatement, that we don't know where that money is going. I would say there's a lot more we need to understand about where that money is going. And one of the big tasks for our committee this year, I think, is to try to understand much, much better where it's going and get a handle on, because everybody knows that HHS budget is always growing, right? And it is a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And we all have a very deep interest in making sure it goes where we think, where we want it to go, and not anywhere else. So I'm totally with you that I think that this thing about trade secret and so on has been an excuse that's been used for many years to keep the public and even legislators from understanding how a lot of that money is spent. But we have certainly have general ideas how it's spent, and hopefully after this year and this next 2 years, we're going to understand that a lot better.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Mr. Ealing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, just a couple of details on that matter. This has been an issue that our organization has tracked for several years. Are you familiar with Buddy Robinson from Northern Minnesota? He has made a couple of data requests in regard to this issue. So after the Timberjay litigation came down from the Supreme Court, the legislature clarified the Timberjay, what we call the Timberjay language, the private contractor language in the Data Practices Act, ensuring that private entities who contract with the government to perform government functions can be subject to data practices requests. So after that was clarified, he made a couple of data practices requests. What he was seeking is some of the core information that would answer questions about how private HMOs are spending state dollars when they administer public programs. Some of that core information is information about what they pay providers, the provider payments, and administrative costs that they incur, and how they define and classify those administrative costs. So he sought that information and was turned down by the HMO on the grounds of there's a classification in Minnesota Statutes 256B, which is outside of Chapter 13, but it's in the regulatory chapter that regulates the HMOs, and there's particular language in there that says that that specific information is classified as not public. So we had worked with Chairman Lesch to bring a bill to remedy that a couple of years ago. That's still an open issue because once you have the detailed data about that, then you can understand how the monies that the state provides are being used. Right now, there is summary information that the HMOs have to provide in reports to the Department of Health. So there's a summary line item of here's what our administrative costs are, but we don't know what is contained within them. And I would note as a final matter, there's only been a couple times when the state has investigated further to see how those administrative costs are being used. In one instance, there was a report called the Siegel Report that DHS had commissioned, I believe, in 2013. And in their limited investigation of a piece of HMO data, they found discrepancies about things classified as administrative costs that have been used for lobbying, et cetera, et cetera. So those questions deserve further research from our perspective.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. And yeah, I'm aware of all that. And, in fact, we tightened up a lot of that after that happened. So I don't want anyone to be left with the impression that that's still the state of things, because that administrative piece we did work on that and tighten it up a great deal.
Yeah.
So things have gotten better in that respect. And, you know, just this is continued, though, to be a big problem because these are huge organizations. There's a ton of money, as Chair Lesh mentioned. And, you know, it's we as legislators really have to get our arms around this part of the budget. But just to, you know, I know we probably want to end here, but I just want to say in connection with this, it's kind of not within the purview of this committee, but, you know, I believe that it's time to end this system altogether. That's why I'm personally not so invested right now in more investigations of the HMOs and more auditing and all that, because I believe we've audited enough and that we know that it's a system whose time to end has come. And that's kind of where I'm at now, rather than continuing to investigate what they're doing and pushing on that lever. I just think we need to move on and get the HMOs out of our public programs altogether, personal opinion. But you'll be hearing more about that this year, I think.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And you do have a significant committee where you're going to be dealing with this much more than we will in this committee, but we will care about the data component of it because, as members here have heard, it dovetails off into a lot of other areas of government. With that said, thank you very much for coming and testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ealing, we'll look forward to hearing from you more. And members, before we adjourn, I'm thinking about Chair Johnson's point of the homework. I do have some homework for you, okay? And it's to watch a movie. Everyone loves movies.
I
don't know. It might be, but it's called The Post.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's a great movie, and I can't remember where I saw it. I think my wife and I watched it on vacation one time or something, didn't we? Was it a vacation movie? Yeah, a vacation movie. Members, this is important because it's about how the Pentagon Papers incident unfolded, which was a big and a major scandal in our nation about the refusal to disclose certain important government data about what the government knew at a certain time and how it was making decisions for its citizens that was not consistent with the public statements that were being made. And the reasons for that at the time were paraphrased, I guess, by the South African folks that met with Chair Scott about this is important because we are protecting you. This is about your security and your safety. And at the end of the day, we live in a republic, and that is the decision of the people to decide how we want to be protected. And it also relates very much to how we classify confidential data. When law enforcement says this is for your own safety, this is for your own good. At the end of the day, it's our decision about whether that's for our own good and all of our own good. And so I think it mirrors a lot of the decisions that we have to make in this committee. When you see how the narrative of the Post unfolds. And also, it's just a really good movie, right? Okay. So thank you. With no other comments, we will reconvene on Tuesday. And with that, committee is adjourned.